So we're going to follow the order I was given: Gita, Philip, and then Amir. So Gita, please.
So it's a pleasure to be here. This is the overview panel, so I feel I should say a few words about what I've heard over the last couple of days. We're here to discuss challenges for monetary policy making, and we've had several excellent papers, two excellent speeches by Chairman Powell and by Governor Carney, and I think we've had really a terrific discussion where many points have come up. The broad takeaway I took from these deliberations were that clearly, you know, the goals of price stability, low unemployment, closing output gaps, and the challenges to attain that, you know, goes beyond the kind of the classic imperfection, which was how do you do it when prices don't adjust flexibly enough or fast enough, right? So now we're in a world where how do you achieve these goals of price stability and full employment when financial markets are imperfect and imperfect in many ways? Capital markets are highly integrated and capital is highly mobile across countries. Countries are buffeted by external shocks, including spillovers from the dominant currency country, which is the U.S. And what we've learned is that, firstly, when you have these presence of these factors, in addition to imperfections in pricing, then these factors can amplify shocks. So, for instance, Silvana, when talking about commodity prices and the impact of that on commodity exporters, highlighted the fact that when you have a working capital channel, then you can get the amplification that comes through the working capital constraint, and then that has implications of the kind that monetary policy needs to respond more aggressively than it would do in the absence of financial market constraints. Then there was a question that just looking at interest rate differentials is not enough to get a sense of the divergence in monetary policy stance. Shebnam talked about the role of risk premium. Arvind and Hano talked about the role of convenience yields. And so if we want to think about what's happening to exchange rates, we want to think about what's happening to spillovers, we have to look beyond just interest rate differentials. And Alan talked about how for pretty much every country in the world, if you look at the celestial R star, that depends heavily on global factors. And so in that sense, it's kind of hard to ignore the global environment when making local monetary policy decisions. Governor Carney, in his lunch speech, also talked about the fact that for many small open economies and emerging markets specifically, the nature of the shocks matter, and you can be in environments which are risk-off, and in which case the kind of the classic advice of let your exchange rates basically do all the adjustment may not work. Tenacio talked about the importance of having systematic policy frameworks to be able to communicate clearly and transparently and to be more effective as a monetary policymaker. And so here is going to be my launching off point into my own views on this particular topic, which is, yes, indeed, it kind of is the case that there are many more frictions than what went into the first generation or second generation of New Keynesian models, which was entirely about pricing frictions. There are financial frictions that are important. But that also means that we need to start thinking more about the policy frameworks that we use, because most countries in the world are trying to balance these different imperfections in response to many different kinds of shocks. So at the International Monetary Fund, what we're doing is we're working on what we call this integrated policy framework. And just to put that very simply, it's basically to say that let's think of the possible toolkit for a central banker. You know, think at this point about monetary policy, interest rates, foreign exchange intervention, capital flow measures, which I will sometimes call capital controls, and macroprudential policy. So these four policies, when you have these four instruments, and all these instruments can be used to affect the outcomes that you want, how do you use this in an integrated way? And why is this important, and why do we need to do this now, and why do we think that this is an important agenda? If you move to slide two, that gives you one motivation for it, which is that firstly, the countries do it. The countries have indeed used various policy tools for macro management. And again, so for instance, if you look at the top left graph, what you see is episodes for several small open economies, both advanced and emerging economies, where you have, because this was 2011, you had the initial rounds of quantitative easing, you have capital flows going into these countries, and you can see that several of them use macroprudential measures, some of them use capital flow measures, and so it gets used on a regular basis. And similarly, on the second two graphs on the right, you see during an outflow episode, which happened in 2018 as the Fed was raising interest rates, that you had countries intervening in their foreign exchange market. So for one, it was done using policy rates, which is that you had countries, some countries were raising policy rates, some countries were cutting policy rates to buffer themselves from this particular shock because it was causing their exchange rates to depreciate a lot. And also you had intervention in reserves in these different countries. So clearly, countries do it. We need a better understanding of how we use these different tools. And again, to be effective, we certainly need a better framework. The second reason why you're doing this integrated policy framework is that we've come a long way from the assumptions of Mundell Fleming, which I think was one of the, there's a bedrock of monetary, of policy making. You know, there are good reasons that when you have people pricing in their own currency in international markets, financial markets are complete, that you would do what, which is the first best thing, which is that the exchange rate do all the adjustment. But if you look in the data, of course, country characteristics vary, and it moves quite a bit from the Mundell-Fleming assumptions. So again, if you look, this is slide three. If you look at the leftmost graph, if you look at the currency of export invoicing, most countries are pricing in a third currency, which is not their currency. It's not. It tends to be the dollar, unless you are in the European Union or closely trading with the European Union, then you tend to use the euro. But it is one or the other. It is not your own currency. Second, in the middle graph, what you see is that if you look at the non-financial corporate debt market, you see there's a lot of foreign currency borrowing. And you can see that for many countries to varying degrees. This is a point that was made by Shebnam in her talk, by Arvind and Hano in their talk. So there is a clear issue here of currency mismatch. And that can be one reason why countries like Brazil, Indonesia, and Peru, for instance, want to limit their exchange rate movements. And then, of course, there are imperfections in foreign exchange markets, and we've seen discussions of that already. An empirical counterpart to that is looking at FX market turnover. There's, again, variation. The yellow lines are for small open economies that are advanced. The blue are for emerging markets. You can see some countries, even emerging markets like Chile and South Africa, that have pretty deep FX markets. But then you have others like Brazil and Peru that have fairly shallow FX markets. So moving to the next slide, I can give you a sense of how is it that we're thinking about this at the fund. And here I'm speaking specifically about the work being done in the research department. There's other work being done in other departments too. Is exactly what we call modeling an integrated policy framework. And I think it is essential here to, in doing this, is to recognize that the shocks matter, and this has come out clearly in the presentations today. The country characteristics matter, and then the combination of those feeds into how you respond using those four instruments that you have, which is monetary policy, which is here in this case is interest rate policy, capital controls, FX intervention, and macroprudential policies. So in terms of the the shocks that we want to think of, we want to think of the fact that there are real shocks, which are productivity shocks, commodity price shocks, but there are also financial market shocks, like what happens with world interest rates, with debt limits, which is risk-off, risk-on episodes, what happened to capital flow shocks. Again, traditionally, we've tried to think of productivity shocks because we're so good at working with those. But in reality, most of the shocks that most countries face with are on the financial side. On country characteristics, it matters what kind of, what's your trade invoicing currency, how big of a commodity exporter you are, how much your currency mismatch do countries have, how big is the debt that you have in these economies, what's the depth of your foreign exchange market, and similarly, what kinds of imperfections you have in domestic credit markets. And that's going to feed into it. So that's the approach we are taking. And, you know, there's some parts of it that we finished, which I've kind of highlighted in red, ongoing and planned. Again, the completed parts, I think it's a bit ambitious to say it's completely completed at this point, but we've done more work on it than on the other parts. So what I'm showing you here is, again, just to remind you that this is work in progress, and so it's preliminary, and I should have said this right at the beginning, which is it doesn't reflect the views of the board or the IMF. This is the views of the research department at this point. And again, we're in exploratory stage over here, but let me tell you about what we have at this point. Okay, so move to slide 5. Just quickly, that's going to give you a very quick flavor of the kind of model that we are using. The idea is to think of a small open economy, micro-founded, which has tradable sectors, non-tradable sector, commodity sector. And in the tradable sector, you can have pricing either in the traditional Mandel-Fleming sense of you have producer currency pricing, which is in your own currency, or in the dominant currency. So what do we have here? So in the model, what you have here is you have this setup where you have households that access domestic debt markets and financial intermediaries that access international markets. And of course, households can interact with these domestic financial or foreign financial intermediaries. And so in addition to the pricing imperfection that we all know and love, we have two forms of inefficiencies that come in here. The one is the borrowing constraint, that because households are limited to the amount that they can borrow that depends upon their own local currency income. And because that constraint can bind occasionally, not all the time, but it can bind occasionally, you can have a situation where because households or private agents don't internalize the effect of their borrowing decisions on, say, the exchange rate, which then enters into their borrowing constraint, you can have overborrowing in this economy. So that's one form of inefficiency. The second form of inefficiency is that financial intermediaries have limited appetite for local currency debt exposure, right? So this was brought up again in both Shabnam's work and Arvind and Hano's work, which is that financial, and even in Wenjin's discussion, which is that financial intermediaries don't treat local currency bonds and foreign currency bonds as perfect substitutes, and therefore, depending upon how much they have to hold of these different kinds of bond, that affects their exchange rate, they can affect the exchange rate of the countries. So moving on to the next slide, which is slide 6, you see policy trade-offs. I think one of the great things of the Mandel-Fleming framework, which I think has lasted so long, is because it's really clear how things work in those models. With a lot of the new Keynesian DSG models, sometimes one gets lost in the weeds. So let's think of the trade-offs over here. So when you think of the flexible exchange rate, so in the standard virtue of it would be that it brings you great expenditure switching effects, which is that your exports can go up and your imports can will decline when you have a depreciation of your exchange rate, and that's the benefit of one of the benefits of having a flexible exchange rate. But on the other hand, it has negative balance sheet effects if you're a country that has currency mismatch and high levels of debt. And secondly, of course, balance sheet mismatch problem can be asymmetric. So it might be an issue when your currency is depreciating, but it need not be an issue when your currency is appreciating. The second is on capital controls. The benefits of having capital controls is that you can prevent, if you use it in a prudential way, it can prevent overborrowing and alter debt and consumption profiles. But on the downside, you're obviously distorting capital flows. When you look at intervention in foreign exchange markets, the benefit of that is if you can actually do FX intervention, which takes the form of sterilized effect intervention, which means that you're trading off domestic and local domestic currency bonds and foreign currency bonds, and because of that, you're affecting the exchange rate. If that is indeed an effective enough channel, then you can separate out interest rate policy from it. And so you can use interest rate policy for domestic market stabilization, use the exchange rate for these kinds of FX risks. So that's a plus to it. The downside, of course, is that there are costs to doing these kinds of FX intervention because you have to typically accumulate foreign exchange reserves. If you're going to accumulate foreign exchange reserves, you're going to basically buy low-return foreign currency bonds and you're going to be selling high-return domestic currency bonds. And so there's a carry cost associated with it. So it's not something that, it is costly and not costless. Okay, so that's kind of the framework of the basic way, kind of, again, preliminary that we're thinking about. But I want to leave you with three basic remarks of what we comes out of thinking about an integrated policy framework. The first is that, you know, again, we have to remind us, so this is slide 7, remark 1, is that not all instruments affect all imperfections, okay? So this is comes close to a little bit of what Chair Powell said yesterday, which is that, I mean, what you do does depend upon whether that particular policy is going to address the problem that you are facing. And so let me give you a very specific example, which is that, again, to say this in very simple words, it means that just because you have a policy tool doesn't mean that you should use it because it may not address the imperfection that exists in the economy. So let's take the simple example. Suppose you have the shock as a real productivity shock in a country. And again, what's the country characteristic? This is the dominant currency pricing country, so everybody prices, say, in dollars, and you have deep FX markets. Suppose you have a productivity shock in your economy, where prices are sticky, then you have positive productivity shock because there's not enough demand that goes with it because prices aren't adjusting. You do what standard monetary policy says you should do, which is that you cut interest rates and you stimulate the economy. When you are selling internationally in terms of dollars and those dollar prices don't change, then you do get some expenditure switching, but you don't get the full effect of it. So you still have a negative output gap. You cannot close the negative output gap. And so then the question is, well, if you're a policymaker and you have capital controls as a tool, should you use it because you have now this negative output gap? Do you want to move consumption today relative to tomorrow so that you can close this gap? And the answer is no. Because capital controls help you with an overborrowing problem, but they don't help you with the issue of the price stickiness in the international markets in the foreign currency. So this is not an obvious result because there are other cases where, for instance, if you are at the zero lower bound, you might use capital controls. But this would not be a case where you would do it. The imperfection here is of the fact that you are pricing an international currency in international markets, and by having this instrument of capital controls is not going to do it. The second piece of an integrated policy framework that comes true is that instruments affect multiple imperfections. What does that mean? It means that if you're going to use one of those four instruments, it obviously affects multiple imperfections, which then has implications for what you do with the other instruments that you have. So let me give you a specific example of a shock, which is a financial shock that happens in emerging markets, the debt limit shock. Again, if you had your only tool was monetary policy, then you would raise interest rates. You would cut interest rates because you would want to, it's a negative shock to the level of borrowing that you can do, so you would want to cut interest rates to stimulate the economy, but at the same time, you're worried about the exchange rate depreciating too much, so you'd want to not cut it by too much. So that's what you would do ex post. But now suppose I allowed you capital controls, and actually the right thing you would want to do is use prudential capital controls ex ante in anticipation of such kinds of debt limit shocks that happens in the future. But now once you use that, that's obviously going to affect how you use interest rates when the shock actually hits, because you have lesser of a debt problems, the constraint is less likely to bind, and you have less a problem with local demand. Slide 9, country characteristics matter. And so he has a very set of simple example, which is that if we're dealing with a country which is a major commodity exporter, there's not much of a problem of balance sheet mismatch. You have deep FX markets. Then in that world, the first best would look like Mundell-Fleming, which is let your exchange rate move flexibly and work as a shock absorber. So you can think of examples of Chile and Australia where flexible exchange rates, for instance, do all the work. But on the other hand, if you think of countries like Brazil, Malaysia, and Peru, where you have the bigger problems of FX mismatch, shallow FX markets, and the shocks take the form of shocks to the debt limit or capital flows, you know, that's going to then bring in a role for capital controls and foreign exchange intervention. Okay, so I'm coming to my last slide, which is slide 9. Slide 10, sorry. And again, obviously, most, you know, every time you write models and try to come up with solutions, it feels like it's always model dependent. So we spend a lot of time trying to tease out what we think are principles that are robust to all changes in assumptions. So first, there are what we describe as 5 broad principles. The first is already what I just said, which is that not all instruments affect all imperfections, and instruments typically affect multiple imperfections. The second is that for a country whose exports look a lot like producer currency pricing, which includes, if you're a country that does mostly exports in tourism, exports in education, then you can, again, get flexible exchange rates as being a very powerful tool. But if you're not one of those countries, then there's less macro stabilization you get from it. But that said, if that's the only problem is that you have your pricing in international markets in a dominant currency, that itself doesn't tell you that you should be doing FXI intervention. Flexible exchange rates remain first best. What does happen, though, is you get much bigger movements in exchange rates. But if you add on that financial imperfections in these countries, and especially countries where there's high levels of debt and FX mismatch, then you start getting an argument for prudential controls. And then especially if you're a country that's also pricing in dominant currencies in international markets, then because your exchange rate moves around a lot more, it can give you another bigger argument for why you'd want to do it. And of course, FX intervention can increase monetary policy autonomy. So again, this is what we have at this point. This is all work in progress, but I'm just going to flag all the usual set of caveats and concerns, which is, you know, there's one, the fact, the question is how effective are policies in reality? That's an empirical question, and so there's a whole lot of work being done at the IMF in trying to figure out how effective these tools are. The second is that when we're going to start using these 4 tools, it really helps to have a framework, but of course that's not going to be enough. Communication and transparency is going to be important to make policy credible. And lastly, ultimately, you know, this analysis is being done by taking institutions as given. And of course, institutions can change and respond. So one of the reasons you might not want to intervene in exchange rate markets is because of the moral hazard problem that creates, and people take on more currency mismatch. So those are the kinds of issues that we have to think about. But I just don't think that this is an option at this point, that we do not have a framework that can look at an integrated way at these different policy instruments and also recognize the different kind of shocks that affect these economies. Thank you.
Well, very good. Philip.
Good morning, everyone. Thank you, Ilan. And thank you, Esther, for the invitation to speak at this panel. It's a fantastic location. It's a real honour for me to be able to speak today. Given the theme of the conference, I would like to talk about 3 broad challenges that I see facing monetary policy globally. Now, it's quite possible, maybe even likely, that you're going to find my perspective idiosyncratic. Not only do I come from the Southern Hemisphere, but I also come from a country who's in its 28th year of economic expansion, a country that hasn't had to date engage in quantitative easing. We're a small open economy which has prospered with a flexible exchange rate and an open capital account. It's a country where there is strong bipartisan political support for the monetary policy framework and for the central bank. And the central bank has a long-standing triple mandate, not a dual mandate. Our mandate is price stability, full employment, and the economic prosperity of the people of Australia. My perspective is also being shaped by coming from a central bank that at the moment feels the full weight of some powerful global forces that are affecting monetary policy everywhere. So with those qualifiers, the 3 global challenges that I want to talk about are the following. First, how do we navigate our way when the stars are shifting? The second, dealing with elevated expectations that monetary policy can deliver economic prosperity. And the third challenge is communicating effectively with the broader public and not just the financial markets. So if I start with navigating our way when the stars are shifting. Over recent times, there have been very large revisions in estimates of full employment, U star, and the equilibrium real interest rate, R star. And this has happened not just in one or two countries, but it's happened in many, many countries. And that suggests there are some global factors at work here. And the truth is, we didn't predict these shifts in the stars. But because we're good economists, we've come up some explanations why the stars have shifted. Some of those explanations are actually quite good. But the reality is, our understanding is far from complete about what constitutes full employment in our economies and what the equilibrium real interest rate is going to do in the future. Of the various explanations for the global shifts in the stars that have been developed, I want to focus on just two because I think they're important. The first is that there have been very major shifts right around the world in the appetite to save and to invest at any given interest rate. These changes are linked to demographics, the growth of Asia, the legacy of too much borrowing in the past, slower productivity growth, and importantly, increased uncertainty and lack of confidence about the future. These things have changed saving investment decisions and therefore changed interest rates. The second major global change is increased competition as a result of globalization and technology. I think many people now understand that somebody somewhere else in the world can do their job, probably at a lower rate of pay. When the first wave of globalization occurred, it affected the manufacturing sector and manufacturing wages and prices were changed in many of our economies. But today's wave of globalization and technology is affecting service industries. Many jobs that in the past could only be done domestically can now be done somewhere else in the world. And I see this very much in Australia, where many services that once would have been done in Sydney and Melbourne are now being done by people in Chengdu, Manila and Bangalore. There seems to be few really non-traded jobs left. My favourite recent example is the PAs to some senior executives in Sydney now sit in Manila with the communications through an app on the executive's computer, and you click the app and then your PA appears in front of you. This has been made possible by technology and by globalisation, and it means the same forces that acted on manufacturing are now affecting service industries. And inevitably, this extra competition means less pricing power for firms and for workers. There are clearly some exceptions to this, and global technology platforms are the obvious example. But most businesses and most workers feel that competition has increased because of globalization and technology. The end result of these two big shifts, I think, is lower interest rates, an economic system that's less inflation prone than it was in the past, lower estimates of full employment, and the old guideposts being less reliable than they once were. So if you accept this diagnosis, how do we respond? I want to make two points here. The first is that Alan's paper yesterday actually provides the direction that we should be thinking in. Any individual country's interest rates are partly determined by global factors that are difficult to resist and they're difficult to predict and understand. So we need to pay close attention to these global factors. At the RBA, we're very conscious of these global factors. We still feel like we've got a high degree of monetary autonomy from a cyclical perspective because we've got a floating exchange rate, so the textbook still applies. But we feel like we have absolutely no autonomy when it comes to shifts in global equilibrium interest rates. If the world interest rate changes, we have to change ours too. If we don't, the exchange rate will appreciate and that will have adverse consequences for the inflation and unemployment goals. So we have to follow too, and this has been a major consideration in our recent thinking on interest rates. The second response to the uncertainty about the shifting stars is to accept a fair degree of flexibility in inflation outcomes. Given the global forces at work, short-term control of inflation seems harder than it once was, and there's more uncertainty about how actually to hit the inflation target. When inflation targeting was first introduced, there was a very high emphasis on achieving the target precisely and closely as we could. We felt like we needed to do this to demonstrate our commitment to inflation control and to build our credibility. I understand that. But in my view, the uncertainty about the stars strengthens the already strong arguments for a very flexible inflation target, and there's nothing wrong with using that flexibility. From a welfare perspective, what's important is that we deliver low and stable inflation. While people in financial markets might worry a lot about whether inflation's 1.6 or 2 or 2.2%, most people in our communities don't really see much difference in those numbers, and frankly, nor should they. In fact, many people in our communities are incredulous that we are worried too much, that we're worried whether inflation's 1.6 or 2 or 2.2. They say, surely you've got more important things to worry about, and I think we should. In Australia, we've long had a flexible inflation target. Our target is to deliver an average rate of inflation over time of 2 to 3%. We don't specify what average period, what time means, what whereabouts in 2 to 3%. What we want to deliver is low and stable inflation. We also see the inflation target as nested within the broader objective of welfare maximisation. Achieving the target isn't the end goal. Rather, the end goal is welfare maximisation. So a question that we discuss a lot at the RBA board is, how do our decisions best contribute to the welfare of the people? Keeping inflation close to target's obviously part of that, but it's not the end of the story. We're prepared to allow considerable flexibility. I recognise that there are limits to the use of this flexibility. The main risk is that inflation expectations can become unanchored. But as long as you keep your eye on the end goal, I think the risk of that's fairly small. This moves, I want to now move to the second challenge, and that is dealing with elevated expectations that monetary policy can deliver economic prosperity. I think most people in the room would accept the idea that economic growth is not as strong as we would like it at the moment. Reflecting this, in some political systems and in some communities, there's a strongly held view that the central bank should just fix the problem. And while we're at it, we should address income and wealth inequality, and we should deliver economic prosperity for the whole community. We should just get along and do it, shouldn't we? But we all know that the reality is much more complicated than this, not least because there are structural forces driving lower growth. We also know that monetary policy is only one of the levers for managing the economy. And in my view, in the current environment, there's a reasonable case that it's not the best lever to use. Another reality we face is that many of the other policy levers are stuck. And that means that more is being asked of monetary policy than it should be, and I think this is suboptimal from a welfare perspective. One way I think about what's going on in the world and in our economies at the moment is that we're experiencing a series of major political shocks, starting here in the US, and we saw another example of that yesterday. You had Brexit, the problems in Hong Kong, the tensions between Japan and South Korea, and the problems in Italy. So there are major political shocks occurring across the world, and those political shocks are turning into economic shocks. Things we heard yesterday, businesses feel very uncertain, and when you're uncertain, what do? You sit on your hands. So businesses are not investing at the moment, and businesses that are not investing are hiring people, but it wouldn't take too much for businesses to decide not to invest and to hire people. So there's a major political shock occurring, and it's turning into an economic shock. Central banks are reacting to this political shock by lowering interest rates, and this is understandable and appropriate. I think there's a question mark about how effective this is going to be. Any individual central bank knows that part of the transmission mechanism from an easing of monetary policy is an appreciation of the exchange rate. But if all central banks ease in response to global political shocks, there is no exchange rate channel for any individual central bank. We trade with one another, not with Mars. And this means that monetary policy responding to kind of a global political shocks isn't going to get the normal exchange rate effect. And I think monetary easing has its limitations as a result. If firms don't want to invest because of elevated uncertainty, modest changes in interest rates are unlikely to get them to invest. Though we can be confident that lower interest rates will push up asset prices, and I think later on we'll have problems as a result of that. So what are the other policy levers? And I can think of three. The first, and perhaps most obvious, is to reduce the political uncertainty. And I'll leave it to others to reflect on how achievable that is. I won't comment on that, but I think there's a reasonable case to be made that that policy lever is stuck at the moment. I think if we could unstick it, the global economy could look forward to a very prosperous period as we catch up with delayed investment in a period of easy financial conditions. A second lever is fiscal policy, including extra spending on infrastructure. And the current environment, this makes a lot of sense to me. It would help with demand and add to the productive capacity in our societies. And it's also worth recalling them that when interest rates are low, it makes a lot of sense to invest in assets that have very long-term payoffs, and well-chosen infrastructure clearly fits into that category. In many countries, though, this lever is stuck too, because debt levels are high, or there's problems in the political system agreeing on how much extra to spend and how the money should be spent. A third policy lever is structural reform that gives firms the confidence to expand, invest, innovate, and hire people. And that's probably the best lever. Would take the pressure off monetary policy and deliver sustainable increases in our living standards. But this lever too looks stuck in many countries. Structural reforms are politically contested, and our political systems are finding it harder to build consensus about what to do. So with these three levers stuck, the challenge we face is that globally monetary policy is carrying too much of the burden. And that's probably at a time when monetary policy is not the best lever to be dealing with the shocks that we're facing. It's reasonable to ask, what's the problem with monetary policy carrying too much of the burden? Is it just that our shoulders get heavy and we don't like it? Or is it something more serious? And I think it's more serious. We know monetary policy cannot deliver medium-term growth, despite the expectations of some, but the other policy levers that I talked about can. Secondly, we risk just pushing up asset prices, and that will deliver problems down the track. And third, the failure to meet community expectations can lead to a political response that undercuts the credibility and the effectiveness of the central bank. It's hard to know what the ultimate consequences of that could be, but I think probably everyone in this room would agree that the ultimate consequences are not good. So we have a lot riding on trying to unstick these other policy levers, otherwise we're going to continue to feel the weight on our shoulders. The third challenge I want to talk about is how to communicate effectively in this challenging and changing world, particularly communicating to the broader society. I agree with Athanasios yesterday about the importance of transparency, having a clearly understood framework, and the central bank using clear language. I agree 100%. But reading his paper and listening to the discussion yesterday, I didn't immediately find his prescriptions very useful for the challenges that I face. His prescriptions included being explicit about the exact weights in the reaction function, establishing a presumption that policy will be adjusted according to a rule, and communicating uncertainty by publishing the full probability distribution of individual projections. Now, perhaps I lack imagination, but these specifics did not resonate with me, and they seem to be approaching communication from an overly technical perspective. I don't see it as helpful in communicating in terms of coefficients in objective functions, probability distributions, and rules. Now, some people in financial markets and some academics will clearly love this stuff, and there's a case to do it in some circumstances. But the vast bulk of people we serve don't think in these terms. And I see dangers in communicating monetary policy in overly technical terms. The risk is that you'll lose community support for what we're doing. And I think this risk is greater given the first two challenges I talked about, the uncertainty about the stars and the over-reliance on monetary policy. I'm much more attracted to the notion of constrained discretion and giving a committee of people the task of exercising that discretion, getting them to deal with the complexities, the uncertainties, the trade-offs and the data issues that we face. In communicating to the broader audience, I think it's important that we just don't talk about in numbers, coefficients and rules, but we talk about stories that people can understand. Stories about the forces shaping the economy, stories about the trade-offs we face and how we're managing those trade-offs, and stories about how policies are contributing to economic welfare and the things that really matter to people, things like jobs, income security and stability of the economy. And we're still struggling with how to do this, but getting the balance right between the stories and the numbers, coefficients and rules, I think is an ongoing challenge. Just in closing, I wanted to endorse a central conclusion by the paper that was spoken to by Silvana this morning, and that is that a country faced with commodity price shocks can fare quite well with an inflation target and a flexible exchange rate. Australia is certainly an example of that. Indeed, I think about the exchange rate as being the great stabiliser of the Australian economy. The reality is it's much more stabilising than our own monetary policy, so the exchange rate for us is the great stabiliser. there are some features of our economies and financial markets that mean that we're ending up in that position. And I'll just list a few of them. We're largely a commodity exporter, and so movements in the exchange rate cushion big price swings in the price of our exports. We're not particularly connected into global supply chains in the manufacturing sector, so the exchange rate move doesn't hurt manufacturing that much. We have deep and liquid financial markets. We issue debt in our own currency, and when entities issue debt in foreign currencies, they can easily swap it back into Australian dollars to eliminate the exchange rate risk. Inflation expectations are very well anchored, and to pick up a point in Sebnem's paper yesterday, we have strong and credible institutions. So to end on a positive note, even though there are big shifts occurring in the global economy that are hard to understand, it is still possible for a small open economy with an open capital account to prosper in this world if you've got a floating exchange rate and a flexible inflation target. Thank you.
Well, with this positive note, we go to the next presenter. Amir, please.
All right. I knew that following Gita and Philip, this is going to be a really hard act to follow. I'm between you and lunch, so I said to myself, hopefully the dancing last night is a compensating factor. I'd like to take this opportunity to thank the organizers of the Jackson Hole Symposium for an excellent conference. As usual, the conference raises many relevant issues and interesting perspectives. I will try during my talk, which will embed probably my idiosyncrasies, to provide my perspective on some of the panel topics, present some references where relevant to Israel, and also talk a bit about related topics of safe assets and rolling over the debt. So let me start by focusing on monetary divergence and its effect on small open economy monetary policy and its relation to data dependency. The discussion among the profession regarding the challenges created by the divergence in economic developments among the major economies naturally tends to focus on the policy response of major central banks. And actually, the sessions here were kind of illuminating in the sense that they actually did focus a lot on small open economies. However, this divergence also presents a challenge for small open economies outside these blocks. This can be particularly true for economies with major trading partners across the major diverging blocks. For example, Israel trades primarily with the US and Europe. About a quarter of our trade in goods and services is with the US, and about one-third is with Europe. That's in figure one in the handout. Naturally, divergent monetary policy, as witnessed in the last few years, had important implications for our own independent monetary policy. More recently, there seems to be some return towards a convergence in the direction of monetary policy. However, the level of growth, inflation, and interest rates are still very different among major economies and therefore are expected to remain different for a while. So discussing this divergence and its implication is still very valuable. Moreover, as was said here, while divergence can challenge monetary policy, a convergence situation could be even more difficult for a small open economy if it would need to go against the wind to support its domestic cyclical development. So let's get going. The Fed's policy to gradually but persistently raise interest rates during the last 3 years, while the ECB and the BOJ retained or even enhanced their accommodative stance, placed some central banks of small open economies in a dilemma. Should they prevent capital outflows by matching the higher rate of the US among the major blocs? Should they focus on domestic cyclical developments and allow capital flows to affect the economy through the exchange rate? Or should they look for some sophisticated averaging of the interest rate adjusted for some risk premia in the major currency blocs, and maybe add to that possibly capital flows and macroprudential measures? One possible answer for this dilemma is that for some small open economies, do not really have that many options, as markets may largely dictate the response. These would be countries with vulnerable fiscal or financial positions, especially if they were exposed to dollar-denominated debt, which risk or experienced capital outflows and depreciation of their currency. In contrast, those with stronger fundamentals, that is, lower cyclicality-adjusted deficits or public debt ratios, were able to navigate the developments more freely and had to choose a course. The policymaker response, however, cannot always rely on past experience, and that's what I want to convey here. So Israel is, in this perspective, is an interesting case study. We are a relatively strong, small, open economy that is obviously also influenced by external shocks. In Israel, for example, it was perceived during the 90s and early 2000s that interest rates must be significantly higher than in the U.S. Otherwise, capital outflows would emerge, followed by a depreciation and inflation. However, in this round, and in spite of having kept rates very low, Israel faced capital inflows following the U.S. rate hikes, as it was perceived as an emerging market safe haven, and appreciation pressures emerged. A marked change from past pattern. This corresponds with the risk perspective that Sabnem mentioned here earlier and what Governor Carney's speech about the sources of the shocks to emerging markets. This shift, which was only partially offset by a sustained accommodative monetary policy, reflects the structural changes in the fundamentals of the Israeli economy, including the continuous expansion of employment, the current account surpluses, and the decline in debt-to-GDP ratio since the fiscal stabilization in 2003. So these strong fundamentals also manifest themselves in financial markets and are intimately related to the perceived absolute and relative resilience of the economy. So this is like the theory of relativity in one leg. So figure two is taken actually from a different paper of Wengsin, who discussed the paper. It's from Du and Schreger 2006 paper on local currency and sovereign risk, which introduces a new measure of emerging market sovereign credit risk and compares the development of sovereign risks in a few emerging markets between 2005 and 2014. It shows that Israel's sovereign credit risk is low, with exceptionally low variance compared to the other countries, emphasizing the safe haven status within emerging and even advanced economy. So the challenge for policymakers in markets like Israel to deal with this divergence of policies in the major blocs, let me expand on that. A paper by Brender and Ribon and Shalom from the Bank of Israel highlights how the divergence complicates policymakers' work. Until the global financial crisis, yields in the U.S. and Europe were highly correlated, so there was no need or ability to distinguish between their effects on Israeli government bond yields. For simplicity, policymakers tended to and could focus primarily on U.S. yields. In contrast, since the GFC, it appears that Israeli yields become strongly correlated with the European ones, with hardly any correlation with the U.S. yields, despite the similar trade magnitudes with the two blocs and the resemblance of Israel's growth and unemployment rates with the U.S. While the covariation of rates in recent times seems to be with the Eurozone, the levels indicate an even more complicated divergence story. Figure 3 shows the term structure of real rates, not nominal rates. One can immediately observe how Israel is caught in between. For short maturities, Israel is closer to the European bloc, while longer maturities, namely the 10-year rate, is a lot closer to the U.S. And here it's probably one has to echo things that were mentioned partly by Christine Forbes and others, that this relatively low interest rate and reaching for yields environment probably amplifies this sensitivity to divergence. And this is something that one has to bear in mind. So the discussion on independent monetary policy here has aspects that are reminiscent of Ellen Ray's dilemma, not trilemma, whereby independent monetary policies are possible if and only if the capital account is managed. But given that monetary policies are transmitted globally through the financial markets and that capital controls can have many facets, I think it remains a question how effective they might be in a divergence situation. In any case, taken together, these considerations clearly consider or demonstrate the challenges that divergence can impose on an independent monetary policy for a small open economy. The thing is, I believe this new normal is probably here to persist and to stay for a while with us. I want to talk one more thing about that connects data dependency and divergence in assessing whether incoming data are pointing towards a typical change in economic conditions that ultimately will have to, in more technical language, co-integrate with fundamentals and other large economies, or towards a lower frequency process underlying a permanent structural change. A simple example is given in Figure 4 in the handout, which shows how between 2009 and 2013, Israel inflation rate was much higher than its OECD counterparts. Yet, subsequently, the picture turned around, and by 2017, the cumulative price increase since 2009 was similar. Such developments, just as you're sitting around, make real-time assessments of whether policymakers are faced with transitory divergence or structural economic changes a real challenge. And this highlights the difficulty of balancing data dependency, a clear policy rule that Anastasios mentioned, and its communication, and especially for a small open economy, having to take into account, in part of the thinking, the rules of others. So let me turn to the second part of what I want to talk about, and that's connecting monetary policy a little bit and financial markets. There's been an extended discussion here about monetary policy and financial markets. Their interaction of the two affects forecasting, policy, and its potential effectiveness. I want to connect these two issues. My argument is the effect of monetary policy on financial markets are state dependent and importantly depend on the phase of the business cycle. Here, I rely on some work of mine together with Cao Lo and Dong Ho Song. I'll just emphasize that the title of the paper, which is Fearing the Fed, How Wall Street Reads Main Street, is from 2016, was given long before I ever imagined I would become a governor of a central bank. basically what it shows is that if you use S&P 500 future returns, it is shown that the sensitivity of stock market reaction to macro, it's important, macro, not Fed news announcements, okay, is significantly countercyclical and depends on monetary policy. The evidence suggests that the sensitivity of stock returns to M&As, this is macro news announcements, can increase by a factor greater than 2 coming out of a recession and remains about above average for about 1 to 2 years. This is shown in Figure 5 of the handout. The peak sensitivity is obtained when the economy is farthest below trend and at the very end of a recession and at the beginning of an expansion. The reaction of stock returns gradually attenuates as the economy expands, with the stock prices reacting insignificantly to these announcement surprises when the economy is above trend. So although we specifically examined announcements that are not by the Fed, we argue that the expectations about monetary policy stabilizations are at the heart of this phenomena. Basically, the paper provides empirical evidence supporting this by connecting these cyclical responses to the business cycle and monetary policy. We kind of use survey measures relative to their current values to determine the expected direction of the next quarter's interest rate and unemployment, and find a relatively small response during periods in which the economy is above its potential trend with tightening expectations. On the other hand of the spectrum, we find much greater response of the stock market to news when the economy is significantly below its potential trend and there is an expectation for an easing monetary policy. So what's going on here In periods above trend, risk premia, so here's where we're making the connection to some of the discussion about the importance of risk premia and the connection about the fact that the Fed not only influences the interest rate, it in some sense influences risk premia as well. So in periods above trend, risk premia is relatively low. Cash flows embedded in these announcements are broadly offset by stabilization expectations, and consequently, the reaction of the stock return is relatively muted. In contrast, during periods far below potential, risk premia is heightened, creating a wedge between the offsetting cash flow and interest rate news, leading to a significant reaction by the stock market. And that reflects this importance of the risk premia as a wedge. And maybe today we're in a period where not really far below trend, but still risk premia for other reasons is extremely high. All right? So taken together, this evidence strongly suggests that expectations about the phase of the business cycle and future interest rates are key determinants of the cyclicality of the sensitivity of the stock market response. And we often think of it as a measure of, well, potentially affecting even the wealth effect. So accordingly, there's an important lesson here. A, the central banks can actually learn from these announcements way ahead in turn before their announcements. What is the stock, what is the market thinking about their actions? But more importantly, in interpreting market data as an input for monetary policy, one should account for the cyclical position of the economy and attempt to disentangle the feedback between the economic expectations and market projections about the central bank behavior. So that's my second point. And I want to talk at the end about safe assets and move a little bit towards government debt, where I think there's at least I want to point there are some risks there. So the last panel of the conference discussed financial markets and safe assets. There is a growing literature on the importance of availability of safe assets in reducing the liquidity premium, providing a safety premium, particularly during times of economic financial stress. And a prominent example is the paper in JPE by Annette and Arvind. The prevailing argument is that larger debt to GDP ratios correspond to lower convenience yields, reflecting something akin to a money supply for safe assets. Furthermore, and related, there's been recently a lot of discussions about the opportunities afforded by low interest rate environment for expanding the supply of safe assets, namely government debt. One of them was the American presidential address of Olivier. I want to argue that the virtue of safe assets is probably more nuanced. It is affected, again, by the state of the economy as well as the form of the supply. You know, so there's probably a little bit less of a free lunch here even in this manner. So in figure 6 in the handout, which is from a recent paper with co-authors Lucas Schmidt and Yang Liu, also well before I started, well before I took the position, and it's titled The Risks of Safe Assets, it is shown that while a larger debt-to-GDP ratio seems to lower liquidity spreads, as consistent by their evidence, it tends to be also associated with larger corporate spreads. I won't go into the detail of the recursive VAR, that's all in the paper. But you can see in the northwest and northeast subplot of the figure that corporate bond spreads have a positive impulse response to a shock to debt to GDP, while there is a decline in the repo T-bill spread, representing more of a liquidity spread in the southwest subplot. The southeast subplot in this figure shows that the quantity of corporate debt issuances also seem to decline in response to a positive innovations to debt to GDP. These are the empirical facts. I think they're quite robust. So the channel that the paper actually uses to explain this is that government debt has to be paid through an uncertain path of distortionary taxes. The risk premium associated with such financing is manifested in larger and riskier corporate spreads and counteracts possibly the benefits of lowering this liquidity premium. Figure 7 shows the output from the model, which contains liquidity shocks. It's a complicated thing, I won't go into it, but it basically contains liquidity shocks in the financial markets, firms with risky, fairly priced debt, and government that services its actions via debt and taxes. The figure demonstrates the improvements in the liquidity premia in response to a rise in debt to GDP, with the corresponding increase in corporate spreads. As alluded to in the panel, countries will likely differ in how much they will benefit from an improved safety and liquidity premia relative to increased riskiness via the corporate spread component. The data here reflects the U.S., which is obviously unique, and the relative safetiness of the dollar might contribute to its convenience yield, as documented by Krishnamurthy and Lustig earlier today. Therefore, the trade-off between increased corporate premia and reduced liquidity premium is likely to be much less favorable in small, less developed open economy. That is, beyond fiscal consolidation, sovereign default, and inflation are two additional risk factors that cannot be ignored in many small countries. Moreover, there is an inherent asymmetry. The reduced liquidity premium has a downside floor, while in principle, the increased risk premium does not. So these trade-offs also have something to say about the recent discussion of the viability of increasing or rolling over debt without fiscal cost. Interestingly, figure 8 in the same handout shows that beyond a certain debt to GDP level, okay, the real interest rate is greater than the growth rate, a critical aspect for arguing increasing the debt can be costless. Anyway, this comes about from the endogeneity in equilibrium here that both the real rate and the growth rate adjust endogenously and differentially to debt to GDP. What's important here is that beyond the model, it's important to recall that financial markets are forward-looking and might be telling us something about future growth. Thus, in a stochastic environment, when assessing whether the rate is greater than the growth, it is important to compare the current rate to forward-looking growth. Figure 9 shows the 10-year bond rate and the subsequent realized 10-year growth rate, roughly as a proxy to what should have been the expected growth. One can see that roughly after Bretton Woods, after the 70s, the rate is almost always greater than the relevant corresponding growth. So this is purely data. So in conclusion, although in certain circumstances, the cyclical benefits may justify the cost, all of this taken together, this discussion suggests that there are some risks embedded in safe assets and that increasing their quantity in the form of increased debt, at least in my mind, questions whether it can be done without fiscal cost. Anyway, so I guess this was the no free lunch before the lunch, but thank you, and that's it.
Well, the three presentations, in my opinion, were very good, so we have some time. I have to ask everybody to be very short. In the last two sessions, we had some shortage of, I had to cut some people. So if you're talking too much, I'm going to raise this. It's too short. So let's start with Benoit.
Yeah, Benoit Corré, ECB. So thank you for a great panel discussion. It's a lot of food for thought because before we fly back home and feed our own bears. I have one question to Geeta and then one more general comment, both of them short. So the question to Geeta is about the integrated framework. I mean, I'm a big fan of this framework. I like it. It's very helpful. But do I understand it well that the country characteristics are exogenous in your framework? Well, you hinted at the end of your presentation that they might be partly endogenous because they can be entrenched by market dynamics, and currency invoicing is a case in point, I guess. And so the question is, do you have anything to say in addition to the framework, maybe it's an addition to the framework, on how to improve country characteristics to move closer to the first best? And I'm not saying here that everything is structural. Everything is about structural reforms, which is kind of a European disease or intellectual laziness sometimes. But I'm saying in complement to your framework, if you had a magic wand and if you could change, improve the country characteristics to move closer to the first best, to what will be your, what will be your priority. And the more general comment is related actually to the whole of the conference, because a lot of the discussion here was about the dollar, the US dollar being the dominant currency, and the consequences of it. And that's an old discussion. It's striking to see that, 20 years ago, the discussion was about the dollar being displaced by the euro. Then it was about the dollar being displaced by the renminbi. Now it's about the dollar being displaced by Libra. And it goes on and on, but the macro discussion is the same. And it seems to me that we know very little about how the international monetary system would work in a world with more than one dominant currency. And that was a little bit in the discussion between Arvind and Oli at the end of the last session. And we know very little about the kind of substitution we would see and portfolio shifts we would see between these two currencies, and this has huge implications in terms of financial stability. So my plea to the research community is please provide us with fresh thoughts about that.
Okay, now Barry, please.
I asked for the microphone in order to amplify something Philip said, but I want to respond to Benoit now as well. I think Philip's point is really important. Central banks have fallen into a trap of communicating with financial markets and judging the adequacy of their communication in terms of financial market reactions, where they have a larger constituency and they need to frame a narrative in order to communicate with that larger constituency. Other political actors have discovered recently the power of narrative relative to data as a way of communicating their agendas. I think there's a literature in economics and economic history on analytical narratives that provides some guidance about how you meld data with stories as a way of communicating. For Benoit, I think there is evidence on multipolar systems. I think the most accurate characterization of the last four decades before 1913 is as a multipolar system, and similarly the interwar period, one worked smoothly with a minimum of those erratic swings between reserve currencies that Arvind was worrying about, and the other one worked terribly, both reflective of the stability of the underlying policies.
Okay, Peter and Henry, then Silvana.
Thank you, Peter Henry, New York University. So two questions. First question for Gita Gopinath. As you think about your new model framework and policy framework, have you thought about in the context of capital flows? It's a point that's been made certainly over the last two decades by people from Mori to Ken to Jeremy Bielow about the distinction between debt and equity in capital flows and the ways in which the international system is biased towards flows in debt and how this has been a kind of recurrent theme in almost every emerging market crisis. It's really debt that causes the issue, not equity. So the question is, what have you thought about that? Question for Philip Lowe. Just building on something that Barry said, I completely agree that there are heightened expectations, and central bankers really face the challenge of tools that are not up to those expectations, given the state of the world that we're in. And so my question is, given this framework of constrained discretion, what is your view about how constrained central bankers should be at the moment, and frankly, using their discretion to communicate to the broader public, as Barry's pointing out, the limitations, frankly, of the tools that they have at hand? And frankly, the inadequacy of our elected leaders in actually passing structural reforms and other things which really are better suited to dealing with these issues. I point to one example I thought was pretty artfully done in October of 2016. Stan Fisher gave a speech at the Economic Club of New York, which he talked about interest rates, but talked almost exclusively about the supply side factors that affect interest rates. He was a little more subtle in October 2016 than he was yesterday in pointing out the deficiencies of leadership. But I wonder what your view is on that. And then finally, the point about stories, I think Barry's absolutely right. thinking about broader constituencies is fundamental. I'll give a very small open economy example that I know because that's where I'm from. Jamaica has really shifted the dynamic recently on storytelling and realized after basically 40 years of dealing with high inflation and an unstable economy, they had to take it upon themselves, the Bank of Jamaica, to really try to shift the political equilibrium by communicating directly with not people who run banks, but people who run fruit stands and are regular sort of members of the citizenry, in order to change the political dynamic, that basically the demand for low and stable inflation, using, of course, reggae music. So my question is, again, in the spirit of constrained discretion, to what extent are advanced economy central banks willing to be a little more humble and sort of reach out to this broader constituencies that Barry underscored? Thank you.
Okay, Silvana.
Yeah, let me first say that this is an amazing panel. I'd like to reinforce something that Philip said at the end and relates to Gita's remarks. The lack of expenditure switching with dollar invoicing happens in the simple New Keynesian model, but not in commodity exporting economies from Australia to Canada to Argentina. Depreciations do increase profitability, and incumbent exporters do increase production. It also allows producers at the margin to enter the export market, so they have a boosting effect in the economy. Dollar invoicing does not imply fixed prices. In the data, there is a fundamental identification problem because depreciations increase exports, but also lower exports also tend to lead to depreciations through monetary policy loosening or through markets' expectations of a loosening. So it's very hard to identify this relation in practice, and we shouldn't be quick to read too much from correlations or simple regressions. And then going back to communications, the other point, I would like to advertise what the Bank of England is doing. We have three layers of communications. We don't go as far as Jamaica, but there is one layer that is very accessible to non-economies, and that's a step towards trying to reach a broader audience.
I'm going to collect, we have six more. I'm going to collect all of them, and then I'm going to give you time for comments. So, Alan Blinder.
Well, I thought it was a great panel. I've been coming to these since Jim Coulter came to Jackson Hole, and it was a great panel. I thought I'd be the only one to pick up on Philip's very, very important remark about communication with the public. So I'll be very brief, since about four people have already been there. If you go back to the early days of Jackson Hole, central bankers not only were bad at communicating with markets, they hardly ever did it. There was a sentiment that you should burn their fingers, wrong foot them, and so on. We've come on a long, long, not only because of the Jackson Hole Conference, but come a long, long way. We're pretty good at communicating with markets. Central bankers are pretty good at communicating with markets. With the public, it would be a great exaggeration to say we're in the infancy of doing that. And with a few exceptions, there's been almost nothing. And it's very hard. You don't do it the same way. The things that central bankers say to markets, it's economics talk, and the market people understand that. And to communicate with others, which becomes extremely important. So most of the time, that's okay. But in times of crisis, when the footprint of the central bank is huge, or in times when central bank independence is under threat from the political side, communicating with the broad market becomes fantastically important, probably more important than communicating with the markets. And we don't know how to do it. And I think your emphasis on stories is a potentially very important step forward. So I really want to call attention to that and commend you for it. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Next one, Avinash is here. No. So Pierre Olivier. So you get.
Thank you. I thought this was a terrific panel, and I have just two quick questions, one to Gita and one to Philip. To Gita, I just want to I think the integrated policy framework is really a great initiative. But I want to push a little bit on what the ultimate objective is with something like this. And I'm going to borrow from Valerie Ramey's discussion yesterday of Athanasius' paper. It's clear that the integrated policy framework is like one of those rectangular box that we can use where the experts can sort of come in. But then the question is, how does it fit with sort of the nebulous cloud of sort of desk expertise and things like that when we want to fine-tune the recommendations we make to countries or governments or policymakers? And I think there is a question there about, in a sense, about the granularity of the exercise. I mean, is it just about trying to develop some sort of typology about broad strokes on what types of instruments and policies should be combined in response to particular types of shocks, or is it really designed to sort of fine-tune it in a way that could be giving very specific answers? My sense is that it's more in the sort of the first approach than the latter, but I'm sort of curious as to your views and how you view that. The reason I bring this up is if we think about a lot of these new instruments that you're bringing to the table, and of course there have been a lot of discussions about them, whether it's foreign exchange intervention or prudential policies, we still lack what we have when we're looking at interest rate policy from monetary authorities, which is some sort of framework like inflation targeting or policy rules. And I think one area where we want to develop as well our expertise is understanding well what kind of rule, what kind of instrument targeting, et cetera, we could try to provide in the macroprudential or FX intervention domains, just like we have them for, or we at least we understand them very well in the context of interest rate policy. And I'm curious about as to your views on this. To Philip, I want to rebound on something that a number of people have brought up, but with a slightly different twist. You mentioned that the Central Bank of Australia, Reserve Bank of Australia, has three pillars instead of two, and the third pillar is prosperity, which is different from full employment. And I interpret this as meaning that it's something about distribution and not just levels of output. So that brings sort of two comments. One is that, do you think you live in a world, at least in Australia, the way you describe the implementation of monetary policy was reminiscent of the divine coincidence world, is that you let the exchange rate float, you have an inflation targeting, and somehow you achieve low and stable inflation and an economy that's been astonishingly growing for 28 years. So that sounds very close to, you know, divine coincidence in the kind of models we have, where you just implement monetary policy and you achieve two objectives. The prosperity, to achieve the prosperity, you'd need to achieve sort of a double divine coincidence. And so I want your views about whether you think that this is achieved, how that gets integrated into your policy framework, because that's a very relevant and important question going forward.
Okay, I had a question two rows back. I think it's George.
Thank you, George Selgin from the Cato Institute. My question is for Gita also. Thank you for your paper, first of all. I thought it was very interesting. It's a small technical question, but I ask it in the interest of seeking out possible silver linings, so maybe it has some merit for that reason. You use a sticky price framework for your analysis, and it occurred to me that it might be interesting to know what difference it makes to look at a sticky wage version of the model. The reason I suggest that is that it seems that some of the troublesome trade-offs you point to that add to the challenges of monetary policy might not be so troublesome if the world were one of sticky wages. I think in particular of the productivity shock example, where it seems to me, if I've got my intuition right, that you wouldn't have the trade-off that you mentioned. So I'm just curious whether you've looked at that alternative or not, and whether you have any thoughts about it. Thank you.
Okay, we have Jacob, Stefan, and we close with Stan.
Thank you. I'll start with the opening remarks of Philip Lowe. Australia has prospered with flexible exchange rates and open capital account. So with this in mind, I would say there must be very good reasons to throw away these benefits. And so my presumption will be from there and ask, what do we need to do in order to secure those benefits? How can I develop the foreign exchange markets and the capital markets to make sure that indeed this prosperity comes? With this as background, I want to turn to Gita's very useful taxonomy of the policy trade-offs. So in this taxonomy, we have the flexible exchange rates, benefits and costs, the capital controls, benefits and costs, foreign exchange intervention, benefits and costs. So I would just hope that as one articulates the costs in benefits, that one remembers Philip's experience, because Australia was not born with flexible exchange rates and open capital account. It was generated, and those flowers were watered and nourished. The issue of capital controls, one remark on this. It has come up many years ago with the illusion that you can distinguish between good flows and bad flows. And everyone knows that there are some good flows, but maybe we can keep out the bad flows. And I remember here in Jackson Hole, this discussion at least was settled at the time by recognizing that as for the same reason that you cannot develop a diet that keeps out the bad cholesterol and gives you only the good cholesterol, we need to know what do we do in order to have a well-functioning thing. The main context in which interventions of this type, capital control, foreign exchange, they are justified always as an episodic event. But history is a chain of episodes, and what I'm worried about is what is justified by short-term needs really creates long-term implications. For the reason is that many of the institutions that are built to support the markets will be deterred from being built if you really do too many of the episodic things. So it's not a comment about what you recommended because you did not, but rather about the taxonomy as one has the cost and benefits. I will just remember this. Thank you.
Okay, Stefan.
Thank you, Stefan Ingves, the Swedish Central Bank. Reflection on Philip's comments on communication, and that's sort of thinking about what I actually do. I'm a shayman. I'm a weatherman. I'm a showman. And I'm an economist. And out of that, if you summarize the whole thing, I'm expected to be, and I am, a storyteller. I tell stories about the future, and if I'm successful in my storytelling, I can do it in such a way that people say, that's reasonable. And that's because we human beings just simply love stories about the future. And that's part of my job. Now, doing that, it's extremely important to understand your audience. And it's extremely important to understand that you have audiences, using the plural. Yeah. And that essentially means that you talk to professors in Latin, and you talk to farmers in such a way that the farmers can understand what you are saying. And if you do that, then people sort of tend to think that that's a reasonable thing that's going on. But in this day and age, it takes us very, very far from the written word. Because we have learned the hard way that people don't read stuff anymore, they click. And that means that it brings us as central bankers into the show business. And it brings us into the show business in a very odd way, because we're sort of trained to give lectures, talk for 45 minutes and things like that. But you better figure out how to say things in 30 seconds. And that's what this business is all about now nowadays. So that was my first remark. The other one, with reference to what was talked about yesterday in terms of rules and how to communicate, it's pretty hard to combine very precise rules with monetary policy committees. Because what a monetary policy committee does is basically bake a monetary policy cake once every 2 months or whenever you meet. And in order to avoid people dissenting constantly, in order to just produce a decision that produces a story so that you can tell your stories you need to be, you have to have some leeway when you do that, because if you have too much precision, you will never really get to a decision, because people always disagree on many different things. Thank you.
Well, Stefan said people should, we should communicate in 30 seconds, so we haven't done this today. That's the only thing we have not done today.
How credible you are depends on whether you know what's going to happen. I was probably foolish to think that I knew how we were going to deal with the Great Depression when Lehman Brothers failed. But I did think I knew how we were going to do it, and I went on TV, and I went on all the TV channels, and I said, this is a problem we know how to handle. And I said it to everybody. Since I believed it, it was easy to convince people. When you don't know, it's a heck of a lot harder, and I don't know how you succeed except by succeeding, which is what the Australian approach has been. But it takes some luck as well to be successful in an when you're uncertain and when you're justifiably uncertain. Thanks.
Okay, we have 9 minutes. I'll give 3 minutes to each. I hope you can answer. Let's start in the opposite order. 3 minutes for Amir and then finish with Gita. Use mine.
You know, I got it. I think it works. So part of what I was trying to say is I get that the 30-second communication and the differentiality of who you are talking to, part of what I was saying about the financial markets has to had to do with that, that lots of people are interpreting you, but particular financial markets. So I think communication is important. That seems to be the main comment that is coming out of these panels. And I'll just reiterate what I said about the divergence issue, which for us as a small open economy, I think it's an ongoing challenging thing to manage to be between the big blocks. And it seems like even if we're slightly on more a less divergent path, there's still enough gaps there that you got to navigate the ship the right way. All right, thank you.
Okay, Philip, can you explain us how to have luck?
Well, I'm really pleased to see the discussion on communication, because I often get frustrated with the heavy emphasis on the models and the kind of the equations in dealing with financial markets. And I'm always looking for ways of being able to tell stories, a bit like Stefan, and you know, it's a work in progress, and I'm not really sure what the best way of doing that is. Somebody asked about when we're communicating, should we communicate the limitations of monetary policy and the options for using other levers? And I think the answer there is going to be very country specific. I'm very careful not to tell the government what to do. They don't tell me what to do either. So there's a kind of a delicate balancing act there, but at least in our system, I felt there's been a role for me to set out the options, not to say which options should be taken. I think people can often infer what I think is the right option, but I think the central bank, particularly where it has credibility, can set out options for the community, and hopefully that leads to a broader discussion of those options, and over time that shapes the political debate. But I do think we have to be careful not to tell other people what to do. Another issue that was raised was Australian success and the role of the prosperity mandate in the central bank. I want to make it very clear that I'm not saying that monetary policy is what's driven our economic success. It's just one of the many factors. We've had a lot of luck, we've got good fundamentals, we've got great natural resources, we've got a rapidly growing population, and we've got good institutions, and we've had a flexible and floating exchange rate. So Monetary policy is just one element of that. The prosperity element of our objective function, I want to make it clear that that's not about distribution. It's really about the frame of reference. I mean, when we're discussing our interest rate decisions, we often ask, is this going to serve the collective welfare of the people of Australia? That's our starting frame of reference. And just, I'll give you an example. In 2017, we had inflation that was low, was below our target, and we decided not to cut interest rates. And we knew it was going to stay below our target for quite some time. And the reason we did that, in our discussions at our board, we said, well, cutting interest rates just to get inflation up a bit more quickly, even though the labour market's quite strong, would that be in the collective interest of the country? Because we could get a bit more inflation, but it would come with more borrowing and higher asset prices. Is that in our collective interest? And at the time, my board made the judgment that it was not in our collective interest. And we were able to do that because we had this overriding objective of serving the welfare of the people of the country. And last point I want to make is to follow up the remark that Jacob made. In Australia, we tried every single exchange rate regime. We've had a fix to the US dollar, a fix to the pound, a fix to the trade weighted index, a moving kind of basket. I mean, we've done everything. And we moved to a floating exchange rate in the early 1980s, and it was the best thing we've done. When we first moved to a floating exchange rate, there was a lot of kind of hand-wringing that this just wouldn't work for us because we didn't have the capital markets. People couldn't hedge risk, and so there was a lot of kind of managing of the exchange rate in the early stages, a lot of kind of angst. But what we found was that by letting the exchange rate move, the markets actually develop. You can have a mindset that says, well, we can't let the exchange rate move because the markets aren't there, but our experience is let the exchange rate move and the markets quickly develop as long as the institutions and the policy framework is good. And within 5 years, we developed deep and liquid hedging markets that had allowed us to live successfully with a highly volatile exchange rate. Thank you.
Thank you for all the great questions. So let me just quickly go over them. Benoit's question about are we assuming country characteristics are exogenous, and the answer is yes, and what I just showed you, we're assuming country characteristics are exogenous. Now, the way that we think about it, of course, is some country characteristics are probably not going to change very quickly. And whether you're a small open economy or not, it's probably not something that's very malleable. You're a commodity producer or not, that's not very malleable. Whether you are mostly trade in your international markets in using a dollar, that is not going to change anytime soon for many, many countries. So some of this is good to assume as being, for the horizons that we're thinking of as being exogenous. But then, of course, yes, there are other parts of it, which is the amount of currency mismatch you take on, how deep your FX markets are. That is going to be a function of the policies. And so those pieces of it we plan to get into as we continue to work on it. And to the question of how do we think of how does the international monetary system with dollar dominance affect policy making? And I think one of the virtues of what we're doing here is to bring that in, those pieces in. And to the question of how do we change that, should we change that? I mean, there's a lot more research work that needs to be done, but I feel like I've contributed some with this work on what gives rise to dominant currencies. Peter's question is, again, quite related to this about it's true that you now see countries borrowing mostly in the form of debt. Your prescriptions are based on the fact that they borrow more in the form of debt. But what if you were to encourage them or somehow get them to move towards equity? Then maybe the policy prescriptions would change. And again, that's about the endogeneity of the characteristics. On Silvana's point, again, to be very clear, I think actually a virtue and a strength of the analysis that we did was, if you can see one of our slides, we do. The IPF tells you that for a country that's a commodity exporter with deep FX markets with very little mismatch, you do want to have flexible exchange rates. Mandel Fleming works beautifully, so the policies work exactly right. It's not the case that there's no expenditure switching with dominant currency pricing. There is expenditure switching, it's just more muted. And secondly, by definition, the DCP paradigm does not apply to commodity prices because those are flexible prices. So by construction, that's a separate
you know, it's a flexible price story, and so none of these concerns that come with DCP apply there. The question that came up about sticky wages and sticky prices, you know, I'll have to think about this more deeply, but if the only issue is you have sticky wages in your economy and prices are flexible, then you do have what looks closer to Mandel-Fleming. It looks more like a producer currency price. But again, for most countries in the world, you have sticky wages, but when they sell in international markets and you look at non-commodity exports, they tend to be priced in dollars or in euros, and those are not very flexible. So I'm going to conclude with Pierre Olivier's question, which I think is really important, which is what exactly are we trying to get to with this? And here I should be careful because there are many views in the building, but let me just tell you, I guess, what some of us think there, which is that is idea is closer to broad strokes at this point, which is to say that the assumptions we made to derive inflation targeting flexible exchange rates do not hold out in the data for many countries. For some they do, for some they don't. And we need to improve our toolkit to think of how do we then adjust to what kinds of policies we use. That's one. And secondly, it is already the case that policymakers use these four instruments. And so we obviously need a framework that thinks about how these instruments work, what imperfections do they address, and more importantly, how do they interact. And so the idea is to provide such a framework to kind of to start a discussion, to have when you go to a country, it is a kind of a talking set of points that you have, and then, of course, discussions matter. But again, I mean, to Jacob's point more generally about, I mean, just to be very clear, I mean, the policy of the integrated policy framework is not to say that anything can be rationalized, but it is to say that country characteristics matter. Some of them are durable, some are not. So you might want to intervene in an episodic way for reasons that can be well explained, but clearly you also do want to work towards the goal of having better financial markets, deeper financial markets, and so on.
Okay, we're just on time, so I'd like to ask Esther George to come and to thank the panel, to thank all of you. It was an extremely nice discussion.